I feel like Jennifer Aniston on Letterman. Really, that's what I feel like. So. I know that.
What do you think? With all that noise, you want to start off with a couple, about 3 minutes of meditation? It'd be really cool.
Let's get centered.
Just kind of sit there and get centered. I'm going to play a couple of bells here. And if you missed the meditation this morning, it was terrific, guys. Yeah. I'll tell you what. I have contempt no more. So just sit still and just focus on what you'd like to kind of leave up here, if you can do that over the weekend. And what happened? Yeah. We'll just listen to this and sit for a second. All right, guys, we just wanted to just center you in the room. You know, God knows where we're going to go. I'll briefly talk about this, and then we'll get going. Just kind of what we think we might want to go over the weekend. Today, this session, we're going to talk about leadership in AA, and don't get freaked out about that. I'm looking forward to see what comes out of our mouths. Then we're going to talk about the spiritual experience this afternoon. The next one, and then this afternoon, we're going to talk about discovering the life inside of you. How do you get to where we're at, you know, and we're all at different periods of sobriety. We're all at different periods of emotional sobriety. We're all at different periods of physical sobriety. So we're just going to try to talk about our experience. And literally, when we talked about having a conversation, we're going to play off each other. We don't know where this is. We have never sat and done this ever. So this is really, you guys are hearing the same first time that we're hearing. And then we're going to talk about 10 and 11 tonight. We're going to talk about this meditation. We'll just maybe get a little deeper into that. And then we're going to talk about tomorrow morning, Sunday morning, living a life of principles, and the biggie, the power of forgiveness. For me, it's probably the best thing you can do for yourself, especially at a men's retreat. And if you have something that you came up here with, that whether it's a secret or whatever it is, you know, everybody has something that they're holding on to. And if you're clinging to it, you're bound by it. If you have a resentment, the resentment is giving you power. You have to let that go. Sandy Beach said the two best words in AA that you can ever experience are let go. And how do you let go? It really is letting go. It is surrendering. So that's kind of our where we think we're going to go, and whether we get there or not, it's up to you guys, and it's up to us, and it's up to the. You can feel the love in here. There's no question about it. That's embarrassing to us for you guys to stand up and make that noise. But it really is this thing that goes from here to here. It really is that from the academic to the experiential. Because when you experience love, there's nothing like it. It is a power that's beyond all reasoning. So I'll let you chat for a little bit, and we'll see.
Yeah. So this is Joe and I have been friends for a while, and so I was really excited when George told us that we were going to be doing this together, because it's one of those things that you hope you get to do something one day with somebody, and you get an opportunity to do that. It's great. And so I'm a big believer in that we're going to just let the Spirit kind of move us where we're headed. We got some ideas about where we'd like to go, but sometimes that doesn't always line up with where we actually go. But My sponsor is big on having that, you know, which is what I started yesterday. This is a conversation. Mm-hmm. This is just a conversation. There's nothing special about the fact that I'm up here and not out there. It just happens to be my turn today to be up here. That's it. But what we hope to do over the weekend is just begin the conversation that takes place and carries on out the door, by the fireplace, at the tables, in your rooms, on with your sponsor, whatever that needs to look like. That just kind of begins the piece of the conversation. And so all we want to do is be the conversation starters and try to share our experience about what that's looked like for us on these various topics over the next, you know, day and a half that we have with each other. And so I'm really excited to see where all this goes and where it takes to. So thanks, Joe.
Yeah, yeah. And I always joke about, you know, it's Bill says we live in the sunlight of the Spirit. And a lot of times people, you know, see me and Cliff, we come up or we get invited to talk at some place, and I always joke, I said, that's living in the spotlight of the Spirit.
Yeah.
You know, when the spotlight just focuses on me, my ego gets really big. So what I have to do is turn the focus on you guys, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to turn the spotlight in the sun, because spotlight is just focus. Sunlight is growth. It's growing up. It's really what this is all about. So I'm briefly going to read Concept 9. I mentioned that last night, and the concepts are baffling to most people in AA. It's even baffling to the trustees, trust me. It's really, but so the short form of Concept 9 is good service leadership at all levels is indispensable for our future functioning and safety. Primary world service leadership, once exercised by the founders, must necessarily be assumed by the trustees. But we're not going to talk about that level of service. We're not going to talk about the general service, because that really, you guys would be conked out. We're really kind of, we're dealing with the believe it or not, that if you're a sponsor, you're a leader. If you're a coffee maker, you're a leader. If you're a greeter, you're a leader. It is especially if you're new, if you've never heard Dr. Bob's talk at the 1950 conference, it's about 4 minutes, 34 seconds. Clancy used to call it the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how he was so humble, an incredibly humble man. You know, he would even start off, he says, you know, for some reason you people think I had something to do with this, you know, something to do with this. But at the end he says, when you boil all our work down, it's to love and service is really what it is, love and service. And I said years ago, I was listening to the Dalai Lama somewhere. I never met the Dalai Lama or sat with the Dalai Lama, but I heard a tape. And I swear that he said, somebody asked him, what do you think is the most spiritual movement in the world? And without a doubt, he said, Alcoholics Anonymous. The Dalai Lama, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, why? He said, because they talk about love and service. He says, so everybody talks about love and service. Every religion talks about love and service. He says, but Alcoholics Anonymous practices love and service. And he said, and if you can't love, you can't serve. And if you can't serve, you can't love. And he said, what AA has done is taken that and blended it into just a principle way of life. And I would say that at the podium, and somebody said, well, where did you hear that? I go, God, I don't know. And they go, oh, I've tried to find it. I can't find it. I go, and then I stopped saying it. I said, man, I can't get proof. And then I was talking at a conference in L.A. a couple of years ago, and for some reason I decided to tell the story. And I even prefaced, I don't know if this really happened. It could be my false memory. And a guy came up to me, he was about 6 foot 8 inches tall, just a solid rock of a man. And he goes, Joe, I got to tell you something. When the Dalai Lama came to Los Angeles 25 years ago, I was his bodyguard. And I was at the conference that he said those words. True. And I had yet to be sober. And I was, you got to be kidding me. He said, no, he actually said that. So, you know, you're going to hear things here over the weekend, and you might twist them, you might get them wrong, you might get them right, but I hope if you, whatever we say that you can take down, we're going to try to lead you in how we have continued to recover from our seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. There is an article called Leadership Ever a Vital Need that Bill Wilson wrote in 1959, and we both have it copied. We're not going to read it verbatim, but it is a wonderful, even if you're in business, I tell guys that have their directors of big business, I says, read this article on leadership. It'll fundamentally change the way that you talk to people. And the biggest thing that I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is not to talk, it's to listen. It's to listen. And I'll never forget my friend Ron Wynn. He said, listen to the silence in an AA meeting, Joe. That's identification. Think about it for a minute. When somebody's sharing their story and the room is silent, and it's this identification process that's going on. I think that's another thing that Bill talks about, that fourth dimension of existence, that right here and right now, when people go, the Al-Anon say it's an aha moment. Mm-hmm. AA, we just go, wow. The Al-Anons, their whole body feel those moments. But the AA, sometimes we hold on to a little bit. Cliff.
There are 16 non-drinking promises in the Big Book. Do you know that? Everybody wants to talk about the nine-step promises. The foo-foo promises is what I call them, you know, that nine-step promises. That's what they read at the meetings. Whole bunch more promises in the book. But there are 16 non-drinking promises in the Big Book. Do you know that? In the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. First one's over in step five, where it talks about, you know, this idea that the drinking problem will have left us. Step 10, there are 13 of them. It talks about after the 10th step prayer, it talks about the things that, the promises we get, placed in a position, neutrality, all that kind of stuff. But in the chapter working with others, there are two, the final two non-drinking promises in there, which I think are profound. And here's what they are. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. Intensive. I drank intensively, right? I ought to work with other people intensively. Intensive work with other alcoholics. That's a promise. And then the last non-drinking promise is the next sentence. It works when other activities fail. So if I'm doing everything else, if I'm trying to live on 1 through 9 and I'm still struggling, what do? I need to work with other people. Joe talked about love and service. This whole idea of Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles behind it, things we learn here, is about getting me out of the way and figuring out how to serve you more. How do I do that? The more I serve you, the less I think about me, which is a Rubik's Cube for people like us. Right? It's a Rubik's Cube for us. So when we talk about leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson wrote this beautiful piece in the concepts. And by the way, Joe said last night, if you read the service manual, you should have a lawyer, and you should, just generally, because I'm for full employment for lawyers. But anyway, Bill, the concepts were architected by Bill's lawyer, because people always say, well, Bill wrote the concept. His lawyer architect the service structure, and betting that it says it's never going to work. How do you do that upside down triangle? How do you put the nuts in charge of the sanitarium, right? But it's worked. And he said he spent the rest of his legal career helping Bill watching something he knew wouldn't work. So when we talk about leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous, this article that Bill wrote, there's this last paragraph. He talks about the 9 points above leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what we say here? We don't have leaders. We just have trusted servants. Well, that's true. But if you don't think there's leaders in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're wrong. That's just like saying we don't have principles of four personalities. We got big personalities in AA. Mm. Do not be confused about that, right? We got big personalities in Alcoholics Anonymous. But we live by our principles. And leaders learn how to live by their principles, not their motives. Because I have some really good motives that have put me in some bad spots. Right? I mean, have really put me in a bad, I'm just going to help these people, right? Her, I'm going to help her. Have put me in some bad spots. But if I learn to live by principles, which we're going to talk about later, what happens is I put myself in a better stead. So this piece on leadership, the very last paragraph that Bill talks about, that we're going to read here for you, because I don't know, but I hate to be read to, so we're going to read to you guys. So ties into these last two non-drinking promises that our book talks about.
Am I going to read that?
You want me to read it?
Yeah. See, he gets talking about promises, and I went to the first promise in the Big Book. It's in XIII, which fucks everybody up. I love it. So it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. That is the first promise that you're ever going to read in this book. And I think for me, it's the seemingly hopeless state. The seemingly is the key word. Clancy, again, always said the disease of perception. We were talking about perception. It's how I perceive what why did they look at me like that? Why didn't they call on me? Why am I feeling this seemingly, it's like this, and we're going to talk a lot about old ideas, and hopefully you'll come out of here with new ideas. And what are the old ideas? And they're all, you know, you can look at them, and for me, all my old ideas are the negative way I look at you. And my new ideas are the positive way I'm going to look at you. You know, love and service is a really positive outlook on life. But it's really, really difficult to get to that point. And how do you get there? How do you get there? I don't know. It's this, I've been sober over 35 years. And like my first 4 years, I absolutely couldn't stand what was happening in my life. I couldn't stand it. But it wasn't until I got my third year of sobriety, I asked somebody to help me. And that was the first time that I realized what leadership was. When you surrender to another human being and you say, I need help, and then you have to stick around and do the work. You know, it's a really big, really big deal. It says, AA, the first paragraph says, no society can function well without able leadership at all levels, and AA can be no exception. Big thing about Wilson was he was a visionary. You know, our code is a day at a time. And you can stick at a day at a time and get absolutely nothing done. You know, but the vision of AA, if you think about Wilson, how he had to sit back and he developed this process of recovery, of discovery, and uncovering a way of life that took some time. And he was all alone when you think about it, you know. Bob was a wonderful sounding board for Bill, but Bob was a very, very patient, calm gentleman, and he would, oh, Bill, let's keep this thing simple, you know. And Bill was like, yeah, but I can actually see Bill like sitting and stepping, but AA is full of whack jobs, you know. There was a great movie that came out. It was the last Bill Wilson, I think it was just called Bill W. The guy, I can't think of his name, one of the directors. I was at a conference when he was talking about this, the whole process of writing and the history and getting into the archives of AA. And that's one thing I want to say. The Ask-It Basket sounds really silly, but I'll tell you what, there's guys in here that probably need to ask a question. You don't have to put your name on it, but it's something asking a question is just like asking for help. It's the same way. Don't be afraid of that Ask-It Basket. You know, whether we have an answer or not, if we don't have it, somebody else will. But what I was saying was they asked this guy the question. They did a question and answer at this conference. And they said, is there anything in the history of you digging into the history of this movie that found it, that you were amazed at? And without missing a beat, he said, it was Bill got thousands of letters written to him. And he said, about half of them were incredibly critical of him personally. The people did not like Bill. You know, we look at him now and think he's a great, you know, great, but think about it. Think about all the people that you know that might be talking at meetings. Half the room goes, I can't stand the guy. The other half goes, I just love this person. It's just our nature. And people really were very critical of Bill, and they said the one thing that they noticed that he did was that he never, ever, ever responded to a letter or any communication in a negative way. He was always able to twist the sixth step is I hate you. The seventh step is I'm gonna try to love you for me. And he would always put words in that were not condescending, were not hurtful, and they were not very critical. He would always say, I appreciate your input, you know, which is kind of like what the South says, bless her heart, right? But he never, ever, ever responded in a negative way. I am not like that.
Well, he had the pause, right? He figured out the pause. And, you know, the other thing about Wilson was is that one of the things that was extraordinarily difficult for Bill was he couldn't be an AA member.
Yeah.
Couldn't be an AA member. Everywhere he went, he was Bill. And so it was extraordinarily difficult for him to be an AA member. And not only that, because had a difficulty being an AA member, he had his own struggles with trying to find his way. I mean, Bill struggled at finding his way in Alcoholics Anonymous for these very reasons, because everybody hypercritical, because he was never doing it like they thought he should. Mm-hmm. This is what you should be doing. This is how you should do it. So everybody was hyper, you know, this other half faction. But isn't that just the way it is? I remember early on when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, an old guy told me, old timer, said, Cliff, here's the truth about Alcoholics Anonymous. You come here and you're active and you do stuff, half the people are going to love you and half going to hate you. Half going to hate you. The ones that love you, they like it because you're out there doing stuff, and the ones that hate you is because they're not doing it, right? They're not doing it. And so they hate everybody who is. And so Bill's one of these guys that's doing things, this extraordinary visionary. His vision for Alcoholics Anonymous was much greater than the book. It was much greater than the 12 and 12. His vision for Alcoholics Anonymous was much more like a world movement, that this idea of Alcoholics Anonymous could transcend just alcoholics, but we could take this, the world could take it and build from it. And so he had a vision that was beyond what we comprehend, what I could comprehend. And he did most of this, his early work, at 4 years sober. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about that, I couldn't write my name at 4 days sober, you know. And he's putting together, he's an architect of the book. So this divinely inspired document, right, this divinely inspirational work that he and the first 100 coming and going, right? We don't have 100. You know, counting noses, what Dr. Bob would talk about. We're counting noses, where are we coming? They didn't have 100 coming and going, right? You might have had like 50 or 40-something sober when the book comes out that had some kind of time behind them. But Bill stuck to the course. He's a great leader for us because he's such a promoter. But Bill could not have existed without Dr. Bob.
Yeah.
And Bob could not obviously exist without Bill. I mean, the two of them together, you had these polar opposites, right? The promoter and then just the steady plotter. Bob was an in-the-trenches guy. He's a guy, he's working with 5,000 alcoholics. I mean, he's an in-the-trench guy, and Bill's a big-picture guy. And together they have this perfect program really gets put together for us.
Yeah.
The vision that he has.
Yeah. There's a great little line. It says, we are apt to warp the traditional idea of principles before personalities around to such a point that there would be no personality in leadership whatsoever. I remember when I first heard principles before personalities, I believe that if there wasn't for the personalities when I first got sober, I would never have understood the principles.
That's,
I mean,
right.
there was I wasn't attracted. I talked about it last night, that to the whole of AA. I was attracted to one or two people, but I'll never forget there was a guy, Marty Leahy, up in I first started going to meetings in Long Beach in California, and Marty was one of these, I called him a bouncer. He was the happiest SOB I'd ever met in my life, and it was so miserable. I was miserably sober when I first got here. I was really I didn't want to drink. But I hated the whole fellowship. I hated the whole love thing that was going on here. I wanted to be alone. And I remember going to this meeting in Long Beach. It was a speaker meeting on Friday nights. And it was just, I just wanted to get out of there so quick. And this guy, Marty, would bounce up. He would bounce up to everybody and give him this big hug. He was so happy to be sober. And he would see me and he would hug me. And he goes, oh, you want to go to Millie's? You know, and this is, like, oh, I don't want to. They went to Millie's. And sure, I'll go. I had no intention of going. But I would go to Millie's and I would ask him, and I would pull in. I'm driving my little 63 Ford Falcon station wagon, and I would pull in and I would watch all these people going into Millie's. I don't know if you guys, and then you go, oh my God, there goes Cliff, happy Cliff, you know, oh yeah, he's got to talk about this, and there goes Joe, and I just start judging, and I would get back in my car and I would go to a place that I would feel comfortable. It was a bar. I wasn't drinking, and I went to this gay leather bar in Long Beach at 9:30 on a Friday night, and there's nobody in the bar that hour at night. Nobody, and it's dark, and I'm ordering a Coke, and I'm standing by the corner just going, oh, I can't stand being sober. I don't want to drink. And all of a sudden, I would start smelling leather, and I would look up, and there's a guy standing next to me dressed in full leather, and he says, I thought you were going to Millie's tonight. I said, what? He goes, I was at the meeting. Monty was my sponsor, and I run this place. And he goes, you can't get in the bar. You can't walk in, can you? I said, no. And I was so ashamed of myself. And he said, the greatest sense of leadership. He goes, it's going to be okay, kid. It's going to be okay. Just hang around. I'll take care of you. And that guy did. It was just, there was this one alcoholic. That's why I don't like calling it magic. It's so mysterious how the alcoholic personality, practicing principles, will you show up in your life if you are ready for them. And it took a while for me to walk into that restaurant. It really did. But when I did, I think that was my first sense of leadership, my sense of guiding me. And that's all we're trying to do, is guide you. We're trying to guide you towards whatever power you can find deep down inside of yourself. That's that fundamental idea again. That's all a leader does is listens to you taking that breath so you can go, what can I do next? You know, what can I do next?
You know, that's a great thing about sponsorship, because Don The guy that brought me the message. Don was my sponsor for 12 years till he died without my permission. And Don was my biggest cheerleader. I mean, he literally was my biggest cheerleader. The thing about, I think, sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsors can see beyond what I am. I just see me what I am at the moment. I see me this wrecked vessel, right, that I can't do anything. But Don could see beyond that. Don could see beyond. He saw not who I was, but what I could be. He had that vision for me. And he would always be my biggest cheerleader. He would, you know, I would be going to go talk at a, like after about a year or so, I'd go be talk at some potluck that they were having 150 miles away. And Don would just get in the car and go with me. And he would just ride with me, and he would probably fall asleep in the front row, you know, but that was okay. It was all right. But he would get in the car, and he would just go with me because he knew, you know, he just would go. And we would talk AA all the way there and all the way back. We just talk Alcoholics Anonymous. And he helped shape me. He helped shape those early principles in life. That's why I believe sponsorship is so vital in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, some of us, Joe, when he talks about, you know, he's like the lost in the wilderness, right? I'm wandering around aimlessly in the wilderness for 3 years, pinned up by our own principles, old ideas. I'm afraid, fear. You know, I think some of the greatest things, some of the greatest spiritual words we can say in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. God, that's so hard, isn't it? I mean, I don't know. How do we get to that spot? Where I'll tell you another great spirit, couple of spiritual worlds. I can't afford it. Whoa, that's a big one. I mean, you're almost a Dalai Lama when you can say that. I mean, you're almost water walker status. I can't afford it kind of thing. But these spiritual truths that we have about it that allow us to see reality for what it is. And I'm going to tell a little story about sponsorship and Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm kick it around a little bit. Because how we operate here is storytelling. That's how we operate here. Storytelling is so important in Alcoholics Anonymous. Joe referred to it when we're talking the silence, because people listen, and in the silence is the identification. So I'm about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years sober, and I get a call from a treatment center in California, and this kid from Oklahoma is out there. And he said, you know, hey, I'm in California, but I'm coming back in whatever time, I think it was like 3 weeks or something. And he said, I need a sponsor, and somebody gave me your phone number. I'd like for you to sponsor me. And so he goes on to tell me everything he's willing to do, right? And so I told him what Don said to me. We'll see, right? That's the deal. That's spiritual. We'll see. And so Chris came back, and he came back, and he was he wanted to be sober, and he had this cute little wife, and he had two little kids. He had a little boy that was like 8 and a girl that was like 4 or 5, just a really beautiful family. And he came back, was in the early summer when he came home. And so I'm getting to know Chris, and he's got this kid of his is a baseball player. He's 8-year-old, he's a baseball player, and he's the best player on the team. You guys knew that. He's the best player on the team, and he's a pitcher. And so I'm just listening to stories about the kid, and I got Chris, we're doing the work, we're going through. And so Chris calls me one day, and he says, well, my son got kicked off the team. And I said, what do you mean he got kicked off the team? He said, yeah, well, the coach has this rule, no practice, no play. And he went to his cousin's birthday party, so he didn't get to play. And I said, well, that's the rule, no practice, no play. So what's the problem? How'd he get kicked off the team if he did that, you know? He said, well, you know, he's the best player on the team. I go, I got that. Yeah, I get it. He's the best player on the team. Okay. He said, so I went and talked to the coach. Now it's coming into picture for me. It's coming into focus. I'm getting clarity on this deal here, right? I went to talk to the coach, and he said, apparently there were some heated words exchanged. And at the end of that, because he's the best player on the team, at the end of that, the coach says, I'll tell you what, it's probably a better idea if you never come around here and your kid's off the team. And so this guy's just a wreck. And I said, well, where was your son when all this happened? He said, oh, he was with me. I said, oh, okay. He said, I don't know what to do. I said, I do. I know what to do. I said, tomorrow or when the next time they practice, I want you and take your son out there. And you go to the coach and say, coach, I'm an idiot. And I'll promise you to never come to another practice. I won't even come to another game. but don't punish my son because I'm an idiot. But I won't come around. I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. I said, okay, well, you ask. I'm telling you, this is what I would suggest you do. And he said, well, I'm not doing that. And he hung up. So he calls Terry, who's my litter mate, who's my best friend at AA in Oklahoma. So he calls Terry because I got to take a survey, right? I need a poll. I need a poll. I'm going to find the answer I want. I'm running with that one, right? That's what we do in AA. That's the newcomer plan. And so he calls Terry, and he tells Terry the story. And Terry does this. What did Cliff say? And he said, well, he said, you know, take the kid, go back. He said, well, that's what you got to do. And Chris just disappeared on us. Chris disappeared on us. And I heard he was going to some meetings, but he really just stopped calling. And that was in, July, maybe. And so that year in Oklahoma, we had this, what we consider a lot of snowfall. We don't get snow in Oklahoma. We get ice. You know, our 100-year average is like 6 inches. So it's like not much. But this year was a crazy year. We got like a foot of snow in like a day and a half. I mean, it just dumped on us. 2 years in a row it did that. Right before Christmas, just dumped on us. And Lori is, we're going to bed, so it's a couple of days before Christmas. We're going to bed. She's got the weather on because she wants to see what's happening. I don't really care. And on the TV screen comes a picture of Chris. It says, have you seen this man? And it says he left his house at about 11:30 at night in a blizzard, in a t-shirt, shorts, and flip-flops. So left his house. And I thought, man. And then 2 days later, they found Chris. He was frozen, sitting by a fence post. And he froze to death on a fence post in the dead of winter in a blizzard in Oklahoma. And I tell you that story because what I'm willing to do or not do in Alcoholics Anonymous changes everything for me. You know, as I'm listening to Chris tell me that story, I get it. You know, I'm on the phone with him. What I really want to say is, yeah, that SOB, you know, that's not what we do. But I'm trying to live a life of principles today. I'm trying to live something different. And my job is to give the best experience I got. And, you know, I can remember times that I would have fights with Lori and Don would send me back because I'm right and I'm trying to build a case against her, right? I'm presenting all the evidence and I'm winning. And Don would send me back and he would have me apologize to her because, you know, at the end of the day, I'm wrong. He would say things, that woman saved your life. That woman saved your life. And I would have to go back. And so I'm sharing my experience with Chris. Look, I get it, but here's the deal. And so in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I know is that leadership here seems like, well, we're talking about those service people. Leadership begins the moment somebody says, will you help me? Leadership begins. And my experience in life is beneficial to the next person. Bill's article here talks about this, how I convey my thoughts, what I say, the tone I take can set the stage for a whole life or death, it says. For not just for the alcoholic, but for the whole family. For the whole family. I can become so self-willed that I'll freeze on a post and I'll go to my grave being right. Being right. Remember when they used to say this goofy thing to you when you were new sober? Maybe while you're old sober. Do you want to be right or you want to be happy? Both. Want to be both. Right? Both. And what I've learned here is I need to be happy. I need to find a way to be happy in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we have people come into our lives as we work with them that how we guide them, what we say and sharing our experience, no opinions. Our experience becomes extraordinarily important. And I'm one of these guys that I felt like I used to have all the answers before I came to AA. If I didn't know the answer, I'd make something up. I'd give you an answer. And what I know here is that if I don't know, I need to say, I don't know. But you know what? I think Joe's got some experience about that. Let's call him and talk to him about that. Because I don't want there to be, you know, I don't want to convey something to somebody that's not practical experience here. And so when you think about leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous, it transcends all the way down to one alcoholic talking to another. how we share that experience, what we say, how that bears out on all that.
Yeah, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. When you were talking 31 years ago, I just ended a crazy relationship and my life was about to plummet. Now I had just started working with a sponsor and I was just starting to get into the fellowship and I was starting to change. I wasn't as angry as I was. But 31 years ago in San Diego, it was one of the first central offices in the country that did a 24-hour live phone bank. They used to be open from, you know, the business hours 9 to 5, and then they would have a phone service come in and answer the phones and go, we'll have somebody call you back. But they decided we needed to go live. And they had put it out in all the messages that we were live. And I had a relationship, and my life was crazy, and I was angry. And this woman said, Joe, would you work the phones from 12 to 6 in the morning? Because I'm wide awake. And I said, reluctantly, sure, I'd love to. And nobody was calling. I would sit down at the central office. I could barely read. But what happened is I had all this literature that I was able to just kind of spend. And then this one night, the phone rang. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And there was this guy that was miserably sober. He was sober 8 years. And he was calling from Boston. I'm in San Diego. And he's calling from Boston. And I said, what's going on? He says, well, you know, I've been sober 8 years in Boston, and I just can't stand it anymore. I can't get a sponsor. I hate AA. I'm just listening to him. And I start laughing. And he says, what's so funny? I said, do you know anybody in the city that you might have some connection with? He said, yeah, there's this guy, Dick Daugherty, that he's a pretty good guy. He's a comedian. I really don't like him very much, but he's a comedian, you know? And I went, you've got to be kidding me, right? And I said, you know, Dick Daugherty is the guy that 12-stepped me 8 years ago on the banks of the Charles River. He says, but you're in San Diego. I said, yeah, but I was living in Boston. And I have to tell you this. Dick 12-stepped me, and he gave me that, there'll come a time if you're done, ask some power greater than yourself help. You'll never have to take another. I've never seen Dick again. I've never seen the man. He died in the middle of COVID. But this, I said, you don't think this is some power greater than yourself that you would, at 3 o'clock in the morning, call a phone number in San Diego, and there's a guy in San Diego that's working the phones because his life is miserable and he wants to be of service, and the only person that you know in the city of Boston that you think might be able to help you is the guy that helped him get sober. And we're both going, this is weird. I go, I know it is. I know it is, you know. No matter how far. So all your story is your story. It is your experience. It is so you can benefit another, not so you can benefit yourself. Your experience is so you can benefit others. I don't know if this guy ever stayed sober. If you ever called Dick, I have no idea. But I have told that story over, and it really happened to me. And then I'm going, now I know why. Now I know why I'm sitting in the central office at this. You know, like when I told a story about Michael. Now I know why I was at the State Line Retreat. I don't belong at the State Line Retreat. I don't fit in at this. And I told my story at this. And then this guy calls me out of the blue and says, your experience has benefited me. I go, wow. That's leadership, guys. It's if you're sitting in meetings and just sitting in meetings and just sitting in meetings with your arms crossed, with the best stay away from me look, I hate you people, I can judge you, I can't stand it, the coffee sucks, everybody, I don't like these people, let me go, where's another meeting? I gotta go, you know? But when your head pops out of your ass and somebody starts telling your story, and you go, oh my God, I never thought I'd ever hear that again. That's leadership. I'm leading you towards something which is called the fellowship. Leadership leads you towards the fellowship, and the fellowship will be the thing that you start to crave more than you craved alcohol. It's just the ironic thing in AA. And I go, oh God, how long does that take? It takes what it takes, you know. There's no good or bad in here. It just is. And it's like and it took me a long time to get to that point where I stopped judging, and I just started to listen. You know, you look around a room; half the room is going, "Well, I get this," and the other half is going, "Oh God, was he shut up?" You know, that's human nature. It's just, you know, you go to a dog park with your dog; half the dogs are having a great time. Then there's two or three other dogs that are over there going, "Knew each other, dog." It's just the nature of the beast, you know. And I think what we do in here is we. What is it that you don't feed the the wolf that you're. That you don't feed the wolf that you want. Just feed the. Get the new idea. Get the love. And how do you do that? You gotta strip yourself naked of all pretense and defense. There's a wonderful pamphlet called "The Members' Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous." If you guys have never seen it, it is a brilliant. It was really a transcribed talk that this guy gave, but it's just like. It's just some profound experiential stuff that people would share to help somebody get over the hump. The hump is always there. It's always there. My sponsor. There's a line in the 12 and 12 about, you know, be the hole in the donut. You know, I don't want to be the hole in the donut. If I surrender to God, if I surrender all this, I'll be the hole in the donut. And my sponsor goes, be the hole in the donut. Says the donut comes and goes, but the hole is always there. There's the seemingly hopeless state. See, I'm going, oh my God, I can't. And then the hole is always there. Think about it. Some of these sponsors are like, where did you come up with that? I don't know. I was taking a crap one day and I thought about it. You know.
Well, they say all that sponsorship, they say all that Zen stuff too, right?
Because
you're like, you come into them and you're like, your world's coming apart. And they say things like, well, you just need to let go. And you're like, what? Like, how do you do that? And they go, just hang on. I mean, they say that stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you're going, bang, 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 bang.
What? Yeah, I don't get that. What are you talking about? Sponsorship is great. I love alcoholics. I mean, how can you not love alcoholics, man? We need help. I mean, there's a reason we're here, right? We need each other so desperately. You know, I just love them. I got... I'll tell you another story about a guy. So about 10 years ago, I get a call from every year they ask me to come down to the University of Oklahoma to the law school class and tell my tale of woe to their ethics class. They think that's a big deal, apparently. Right? And so I don't mind coming telling you people, but I go down there with a bunch of like 22-year-olds who think that are about to get the world by the tail, you know. So they like me to come down and do that, which is my least favorite thing to do ever is to go. But you know what I say? Okay, I'll come. And but invariably when I go down there, what happens is, because I always put my name on the board. I don't talk about AA. I found a 12-step fellowship. And anyway. But invariably when I go down there, somebody calls me. Somebody calls me. There was... I was down there one time. This is not a sponsorship deal, but it's pertinent because the young lady just had 9 years 2 days ago. So I'm down giving my talk, and afterwards, what I would say was a little girl that came to see me because she was, you know, she's probably 22, 23 at the time. She came to see me. She says, "I'm here. I'm 2 years sober. I'm dying. I'm dying. I moved here from California. I got accepted to law school. I'm here and I'm dying." And I don't know what to do. And so she's paralyzed by fear because she's new sober. She moves to Oklahoma. She's not going to AA because she's afraid. And she's doing law school, and she's just paralyzed by fear. And I said, that's okay. I know some women. I'll get you dialed in. And great groups in Norman. I got her plugged in there. She just celebrated 9 years, which was great. Found a guy, met a guy in AA. They got like 2 kids now. It's a beautiful thing, right? And I get a cheap seat to all that, right? I just get a cheap seat to that. But the beautiful part was about 3 years ago, right after COVID, so 21, so 2 years ago, I'm doing a book study in Oklahoma City, and her dad came. And he's 35 years sober in AA. At the time, he was 20-something years sober, and I call him. He's in California. And his daughter's dying in Oklahoma, you know, that's the deal. And at a break, Lauren brings her dad and introduces me to him. And you know what this is like? You just get embraced. Mm-hmm. Right? Just embraces you. And you have this feeling, and he's so grateful. And we play these bit parts. See, I could make that all about me, but it's a bit part. It's the guy that answers the phone to the guy who's the one person. It's that we get bit parts, and when we can figure out that, hey, I'm a bit part actor in this deal. Third step talks about I got to play the role that God assigns me. Bob is always big on I'm the pipe, not the well. Mm. God flows through me. He is not of me. It flows through me. And when we're open to that, when I'm willing to say yes, that's the key. I think a big key in Alcoholics Anonymous is just being willing to say yes. I don't want to go to Norman and talk to those chuckleheads. You know, I don't want to go do that. Their egos are out of control. I create all this stuff in my head. But by doing that, what's happened to me is I've opened a channel. And I think that's a big deal. Just saying yes, we open the channel. So one more story about all that. So I'm down there 10 years ago, and about a year later, I get a call from the professor down there. Says, hey, there's a guy that called me, and he wanted your number. I want to know if I could give it to him. I said, absolutely, you can give my number to anybody if you think I can help them. And so this guy calls me, and he says, I want to know if I can come see you. I said, yeah, sure, be well. He said, I've got a friend. I said, yeah, come on. And so he shows up with another guy and Seth's soon-to-be ex-wife, and she's mad. I mean, she's mad. She's mad like all your wives were mad before you got here. I mean, she's mad. Thank God Lori was there. I just said, here, you need to go talk to her. But she is pissed because he's done everything we do, right? He can't come home at night. She's caught him with other women. He's drunk all the time. He works for this big law firm down in Oklahoma City, and they're about to bring the hammer. They're about to fire him. And so I talked to him. I said, yeah, give him... You know, here's the deal. I'm happy to talk to him, but he's got to call me because I don't, you know, he needs to call me and I'll go do whatever. Because you guys tell me he wants to be sober. I mean, that you want him to be sober. He's got to, you can't take the first step for him. He's got to be willing to do something. So anyway, so about 4 months later, Seth calls me. He tells me he's been to outpatient treatment. He wants to know if I can give him some kind of certificate for sobriety. Certificate. I said, you know, I quit giving those. They just don't seem to work. I quit issuing certificates. So he comes to an AA meeting. I take him. It's a speaker meeting. I think maybe he can hear something. He doesn't hear anything because he's not alcoholic. Yeah, if you're not alcoholic, AA not going to do you any good, right? So I don't hear anymore from Seth about 5 months, and his friend calls me and says, Seth's in treatment, will you go see him? I said, yeah, where is he? So I go see Seth. He's about an hour and a half away, so I drive up to see him. Seth gets out. Now he's divorced. She's gone. They have a little girl. They're gone. And Seth comes, and he hangs out for about 45 days, relapses, because he can't give himself this simple program. He's trying to still hang on to some old ideas. So finally, the relapse, he calls me, though. He's on it. He calls me and says, I'm scared to death. I relapsed. And so I said, well, come over here. Sit at my conference table. You sit there till you're done writing your fourth step. I just parked him there, gave him a book, yellow pad, said, just write. So Seth begins to do the work, and he's getting into it. And at about 2 years sober, he figures out, I'm still in love with my wife. It's a revelation to him. Now, I'm still in love with my wife. And so, but she won't talk to him. She hates him. She hates him. And as they do. And so he's at my house one day, and we're talking, and this is brilliant. This was brilliant. He's talking to me, and my wife says, why don't you start dating her again, but don't let her know you're dating her? He goes, how do you do that? He said, well, you invite her to lunch to talk about your daughter, and you go there and you talk about your daughter. So Seth started doing that. He started dating his wife, and she didn't know it. That's good. It's a trick. And then he says, why don't you take her to dinner and invite Harper? You guys go say it'd be good for Harper. We all can do something together. And I'll be damned. After about 2 years, there's this peculiar law in Oklahoma that if you've been divorced and never remarried, you can go in on motion and set aside your decree, and it's as if you've never been divorced. Wow. And 2 years later, that's what happened. And a family got reassembled. And a mother, child were reunited with the husband and the father. I told that story to Byzance. I'm telling him the story. He starts crying. He's 53 years sober when I started. He's crying. Because that's the power. Right. That's the power we have here. That's the power we deal with here. I hate him. I'm done with him. And yet here they are reunited, happy, joyous, and free, right? They're back in this family reassembly. Don't doubt the power we deal with here. Don't confuse what we're dealing with here. This love and service gig, that we give it some lip service. There's a power here. And I remember when I was listening to Lori, because she's got good leadership, right? I remember when I was, what I thought when she said that, I go, well, this ain't never going to work, right? So this is never going to work. She probably won't even go to lunch with you. I'm thinking, I don't say it because I'm smart now. I don't say it in front of her, right? But it worked. And God reassembled that family. How important is it what we do here? And understand our roles as just, hey, conduits, I'm a channel. I'm bringing this to the table. It's power in that.
It's some incredible power. You know, when the Bill first started writing the book, if you go into it, he writes in such a way that when he talks about building a foundation, we're constructing a foundation of sobriety so we can reassemble the lives that we've destroyed. That's really what's happening here, and it's just, I think that's how the chapter, Working with Others, for me, is just an incredible chapter. I'm just going to read a couple, and if you've never heard the nevers in AA, there's some nevers in here, but let me read a couple of lines first, and these are some more promises. It says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. How many times if you're talking to somebody and they're worried about, they're worried about Christmas, and it's February.
Right? Yeah.
Why don't you go work with somebody? You don't understand. You're not listening to what I'm saying. Yeah, I am. I just, we say shut up without saying shut up. That's what we do, And it's really, that's just what we try. It says, life will take on a new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow about you. And I'm going, why did he phrase it about you? No, I'm a weird one now. I told you I could barely read, but the dictionary has helped me to understand why things are written this way. So I looked up the word about. I know what about means, right? But I look it up in the dictionary, and it says a circle around. Think about that. The circle and the triangle is the symbol that AA used for a long time, a circle around. And you think about what we do is we circle around the newcomers. We circle around the people that are struggling with alcoholism. You don't have to be new. You can have 40 years of sobriety and have bad days or bad moments. I think the longer you're sober, they're just bad moments. When you're new, they're bad days. Then when you're new, they're bad weeks. Oh, it's a bad year. I'm just having a bad moment, So it's really, and then he goes on, he says, to have a host of friends. I had nobody when I got here. This is an experience you must not miss. We know that we will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. If you read the big book, it doesn't talk about meetings. It talks about, working with others, being around, being of maximum service. But then he goes into the nevers, and I'm going to skip a bunch of pages, and it says, so cooperate, never criticize. And this is what I segue when you were talking about the family. When your relationships, think about the relationship that might be going astray. Never criticize? Oh my God, think about criticize. What is a critic? What is being criticized? It says, to be helpful is our only aim. Then the next paragraph says, if he does not want to see you, never force yourself upon an alcoholic. Oh my God, if you ever heard my sponsor, Ken Devaney, he tells a story about he doesn't talk anymore, but he tells a story about his first 12-step call. His sponsor, they lived in Brooklyn, and his sponsor pulled up to this house. They said, this guy called the central office, he needs help, he's in the house. And Ken was newly sober, and he goes in and gets the guy, and by the time the guy had called central office and the time that Ken showed up the door, he had changed his mind. He didn't want to be sober anymore, and Ken was determined to get this guy sober. He was determined when I says, never, never force yourself upon him. And he grabbed this guy and he dragged him outside and he was beating him over the head with a trash can to get him in the car to go to a meeting.
12 stomping. 12 stomping.
12 stomping. There you go. So never force yourself upon somebody. And Ken's the one who pointed these out to me. It says, oh, where's the, so here's some good ones. Never talk down to an alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop. I failed. Simply lay out the kit of spiritual tools for inspection. Show him how they worked for me. Offer him friendship and fellowship. Tell him if he wants to get well, you will do anything to help. I'll never forget, I was the first time I went back to Boston, and I went to this, the Paulus Center in downtown Boston. There was a guy sitting in the front row. Somebody mentioned this. I don't know who is if the rest. Is the wrestler here? The guy who was a wrestler? I don't know. Was that you? So I'm sitting in the front, and there was this guy, and he was the homeliest man and the biggest man I ever seen in my life. And he had been a professional wrestler, and he worked intensely with newcomers. He worked with street people, and he would work with them and work with them and work with them. And I was like, wow, this is really great. And he says, but it can be really, really frustrating. He said, this one woman that I know that was wanting to get sober, and she would call me and just drive me crazy. God, she's calling again. Will you leave me alone? She'd call, oh, will you help me? You're not willing to do anything. Oh, my God. And she'd call again. And then she called and says, I really need help, and somebody help me. And he goes, wow, there was a tone in her voice, and I don't know what it was. So he went out looking for her. And he went out looking for her, and he found her burnt to death in a dumpster. And this man was in the front row in sad, sad tears. And he talked about how frustrating it was for him to think that he was going to be able to help this person by not helping her. And I was like, oh, wow. Oh, wow. Because it's a frustrating, working with people, you know, if you work, it can be really, really frustrating. When you pick up that phone and it goes, oh, as I said last night, oh, God, what is it? And it goes on and on. And you just set the phone down and you go put oil in the car and you're doing all, and they're still going, oh, thank you for listening. Goodbye. You know. But the thing is, I take the action and I answer the phone. I got to answer the phone. Never avoid responsibilities, but be sure you are doing the right thing if you assume. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. And this is working with others. Now he switches from helping others to your recovery. The foundation stone of your recovery. It's really an amazing way of life. But he says, your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum help to others, so never hesitate to go anywhere where you can be helpful. Never hesitate. Oh my God, I always hesitate. Oh, I don't want to. Oh my God, there's a great new show on Netflix. Oh, the football game. Oh God. You don't know if you're going to miss the music. You're going to miss the music. And then the last one, obviously, be careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution. I loved drinking. Up until this day, if I could drink like a normal person, whatever that is, you know, I've never been around a normal drinker. When I was 10 in Bar in Boston, I used to start at 6 o'clock. And at 5 o'clock, all the offices would close. And the people would come in and they would like the sippers,
yeah.
They would sit and wait for the traffic to die down. And they would have a drink and wouldn't finish the drink. Or they would wait for the train. And then they would go and the bar would clear out and there'd be a space, a lull, right? And then about 8:36, the front door would go... And Melvin would walk in and just, and I would put the Stolichnayer and cranberry juice in right at his seat. And he would sit there, give me a nod. He would finish that, and I'd have another one, give another one. He would give me a nod. And then the third one, he would take a sip, and he would say, Joe, how the hell is your day going? Boom. Another alcoholic would walk in. Sit at the table at his seat, and I would put the drink down. It was the same routine over and over and over again. And by 1:30 in the morning, that was like the symphony again. It was like everybody was talking, and nobody was listening, and everybody's drunk, and everybody's happy, joyous, and free. And then we got to go, last call, and, you know, the people that I don't know would get up and leave, and the people that I do know would go, can we stay? Yeah. And we would lock the front door. And we would—that's when the real alcoholic would just come to life, you know. And it's so the never show intolerance or hatred. I think every one of us really enjoy drinking, but the alcoholic crosses that line of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's what would happen to me, you know, when I would be drinking alone, and then I used to go to Puerto Rican bars and black bars in Boston, so I could just be an alcoholic. And this one night I'm in a place called Frank's Place. It was over in Mattapan. It was all black bar, and I'm a little white boy, and I'm sitting there, and I'm a little nervous, you know. And this guy comes up and touches me on the shoulder, and I knew him from my own joint. And he goes, Joe, what the hell are you doing here? I go, I'm waiting for Melvin. He told me to meet him here. And he goes, Jesus, these people don't like you being here. And he goes, you know, Frank, don't even come into Frank's place anymore. And I went, oh. He says, I am not going to let you go till Melvin shows up, and then you're out of here, you know. But that's where my alcoholic mind took me to, that I just wanted to be alone. And I, since I got into AA, the leaders in AA have never let me be alone. There's not a lot of leaders in AA. There's a lot of followers. But we're attracted to the leader. We're attracted to the Georges. We're attracted to the Cliffs. I don't know if you're attracted to me, but that whole, it's like, it's we lead you towards the joy. And the joy of living is our code, but the action is the key word. And you'll all know the greatest leader in the world's going to say to you, get in the car. Get in the car. We're taking a ride. But. Get in the car, you know, get in the car, and you get, and then you pick up four or five other whack jobs along the way, and it's just like, you know. And that's the symphony all over again, and we can't, the music has to be in harmonic, symphonic music, and it happens when one leader says, come on and enjoy the orchestra.
You get these motorboat sponsories, you know, but, right, that's how it is. I love the chapter, Work With Others. That there's the part in there that it talks about, one of my favorite parts is where it talks about, and you kind of touched on these things you can't must not miss, but there's the part that it talks about, never avoid these responsibilities. Go through that list, you know, about helping others. You said, you read the helping. You have to be the good Samaritan every day if need be. It may mean the loss of many nights' sleep, great interference with your pleasures, interruption of your business. It may mean sharing your money or your home, countless frantic wives and relatives, innumerable trips to police courts, sanitariums, hospitals, jails, and asylums. Your telephone may jangle at any time of the day or night. Your wife may sometimes say she's neglected. A drunk may smash the furniture in your home or burn a mattress. You may have to fight with him if he is violent. Sometimes you'll have to call a doctor and administer sedatives under his direction. Another time you may have to send for the police or ambulance. Occasionally you have to meet all of these such conditions. But that's where the, what did it say at the very first? This is something you must not miss. You must not miss. And I love that because I, for me, the real juice in Alcoholics Anonymous is when the circle gets complete. Right? When I shared that fifth step, when Don sat in front of me and I did, you know, I did the work and I shared with Don and the lights came on, you know, the lights came on for me and I watched Don smile because he knew when the lights came on for me. And then when you're sitting across from a knucklehead and you've told them for 6 months something, and they come trotting back to you, and they report in what the guy that's just don't drink and go to meeting says, and it's like the lights come on. You're thinking, I told you that for 6 months, you know. And that guy, and he hears it, and the lights come on, and the circle gets complete. This is something you must not miss. That piece of the puzzle, it's the spiritual juice in here. You know, we talk about, you talked about magic. Magic of alcohol. That's what it, the book describes it as an illusion. An illusion. That's what it does. It does for us what alcohol seemed like quickly, what Alcoholics Anonymous has done steadily and slowly. T-I-M-E, right? Over time, Alcoholics Anonymous. Booze seemed to do that quickly. The trouble is I can't stay drunk all the time. I eventually pass out. Sober up, then I'm nuts again. I'm crazy. But Alcoholics Anonymous has done that steadily and slowly over time. But I want it right now. The trouble with instant gratification, it takes too long. That's the deal here, right? So what I want is it right now. And that's the magic alcohol produced. But what Alcoholics Anonymous, I think what it delivers, what we're talking about here is this idea of mystery and miracles. The mystery and miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. We get that when we participate in the full circle. When I'm being a sponsor, when I'm willing to be sponsored, but I'm also willing to sponsor. And those, the connectivity of that, the mystery of all that, the idea that I'm allowing myself to be directed by God, that I'm really doing God's work. Nobody wants to get up and answer the phone at 2 a.m. I mean, you just don't. I don't. You know, I'm a few years sober. I don't want to do that. But that's where all the good stuff is. Right? If it's convenient, it's not service. I'm a believer in that. Service is it being when I'm allowing myself to be inconvenienced. That's where the juice is. When I'm allowing myself to be, if I'm just going to an AA meeting every day or whatever my schedule, whatever my routine is, and it's really close to my house and it's a sunshiny day and I want to go, you know, when it's snowing, the roads are shut down, that's when I need to go. Because you know why? That's where the magic's going to happen. That's where the miracles are going to happen. That's when the drunks show up. Alcoholism never happens at, you know, in my time trying to get sober, alcoholism never came to me at 2 in the afternoon. It comes to you at 2 in the morning. Cliff, get up. I've been up for an hour. We need to get you in the game. Get in here, right? My head starts working on me, and I start getting up, and I start buying it. And so I have to remember that I need to be inconvenienced. Because why I inconvenienced a lot of people. I inconvenienced a whole bunch. My friend John tells a story about going to a restaurant and he had terrible service. I mean, the waitress was horrible. And the bill was like $120 and he tipped her $120. Tipped her. And the guy said, did you tip her the total amount of the check? Did you tip her $120? He said, yeah, I did that. He said, why would you do that? And without missing a beat, he says, because I've been over-tipped for God for bad service my whole life. My whole life. I've been over-tipped by God. Right? That's how we do. You want to read that?
Yeah.
You want to read that?
Read that.
Read it. Yeah.
How about are we done? Oh, we still got another, close to 15, right?
Do we? Or is it 10 o'clock we're out?
Is it?
10 o'clock
and
back
at 10. Yeah, read this. So we're going to read, have you ever heard Sam Shoemaker's I Stand By The Door? If y'all, sir, so we're going to just read that, and it was going to try to tie into what this is. And I probably won't be able to do this without a dry eye, but
that's all right.
I just picture your first AA meeting when somebody was standing by the door, and they said, I stand by the door. I neither go far in nor stay far out. The door is the most important in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they find God. There is no use my going way inside and staying there. When so many are still outside and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where the door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men, with outstretched groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing that any man can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. When men die outside the door as starving beggars die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter, die for want of what is within their grasp, they live on the other side of it, live because they have not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it. And open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door. Go in, great saints, go all the way in, go all the way, go way down to the cavernous cellars and way up to the spacious attics. It is a vast, roomy house, this house where God is. Go into the deepest of hidden casements of withdrawal, of silence, of sainthood. Some must inhabit those inner rooms and know the depths and heights of God and call outside to the rest of us how wonderful it is. Sometimes I take a deeper look in, sometimes venture in a little farther, but my place seems closer to the opening, so I stand by the door. There is another reason why I stand there. Some people get partway in and become afraid, lest God in the zeal of his house devour them, for God is so very great and asks of us all. All these people feel a cosmic claustrophobia and want to get out. Let me out, they cry, and people way inside only terrify them more. Somebody must be by the door to tell them that they are spoiled. For the old life, they have seen too much. One taste of God and nothing but God will do anymore. Somebody must be watching for the frightened who seek to sneak out where they came in to tell them how much better it is inside. The people too far in do not see how near these are to leaving, preoccupied with the wonder of it all. Somebody must watch for those who have entered the door but would like to run away. So for them too, I stand by the door. I admire the people who go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who have not yet even found the door. are the people who want to run away again from God. You can go in too deeply and stay too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my old accustomed place, near enough to God to hear him and know where he is there, but not far from the men as to not to hear them. And remember, they are there too. Where? Outside the door? Thousands of them, millions of them. But more important for me, one of them, two of them, 10 of them, whose hands I am tended to put on the latch, so I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I'd rather be a doorkeeper. So I stand by the door.
Right on. We'll take a break.